It's Sunday morning, time for the great outdoors with Charlie Potter. Brought to you by the all-new Chevy Silverado and ChevyDriveChicago.com on Chicago's very own 720 WGN.
Good morning. Welcome to the Great Outdoors Show. Charlie Potter, your host here on WGN Radio. Thank you very much for joining me. This morning's show, I'm going to bounce around the country a little bit. I'm going to start off actually with some fantastic news. And that news is that after really almost 3 years of drought on the prairie breeding grounds of the United States and Canada across southern Alberta, Saskatchewan, Manitoba, and on down to the North and South Dakota and into eastern Montana, it looks as though the drought has been broken. It may come too late to help many of nesting waterfowl and shorebirds this year, as when the birds arrive in the prairies, as you've heard me talk about, it was really dry. And when those dry conditions happen, a lot of birds overfly the prairies, go to the boreal forests, and go up into the Arctic. And many of them just simply sit out the breeding year. That's how they were designed by Mother Nature over millenniums. They've evolved to try to nest and use the, and take the risks of nesting when conditions are good. And when conditions are not good, they tend to stay off the nest and go to places where they can sit out the summer. And that's why we have such boom and bust cycles with wetland-dependent birds. In years when there's lots of water and good habitat, they can produce tremendously well, but then they shut down in the years that they don't, because to a hen, female species of a bird, whether it's a piping plover, whether it's a grouse, whether it's a duck, being on a nest is a very dangerous place to be. And so if they don't think that they're going to have a successful nest, if the conditions aren't optimal, they won't try to nest. They'll save themselves for another year, and that's how they've evolved. So when birds arrive in the prairie breeding grounds this year, they found a landscape that was dry for the third year in a row, really dry in some areas, southwestern Saskatchewan, eastern Alberta, parts of the High Line of Montana over in the North Dakota were just incredibly dry, historic dry, going back to the mid-80s. And as happened in 1993, when the drought that had lasted almost a decade had gripped the prairies, it started to rain in June of 1993, and basically it didn't stop raining all that summer, it didn't stop snowing all that next winter, it didn't stop raining that next summer, and by 1995 we had the best wetland conditions on the prairie breeding grounds since the mid-1950s. But in 1993, most birds couldn't take advantage of it. The rains came too late. And I think the same scenario is likely to have occurred in this, the summer of 2024, when the prairies started to get significant rainfall. It was after most of the birds had either abandoned the prairies to go further north to sit out the summer, or simply decided that they would stay there and not nest the first time. However, when conditions do improve, re-nesting can be very strong. And that is what I think scientists and all of us who love the fall flight are hoping occurred for birds that were not successful the first time and hung in on the prairies, did not go further north. Conditions now are absolutely optimal. They haven't been this good across much of the prairies now in almost a decade. So what looked like a really bleak year suddenly now looks as though it might be one that held some promise and certainly holds some promise for next year if it can continue. The May ponds and waterfowl breeding census will be out in August. My guess is that it's going to show that we really have a much lessened breeding population this year. So we'll see. Well, moving on from the discussion of water on the prairies, there's great news. And that is the Duck Stamp Modernization Act, which was signed into law on December 19, 2023, now enables the federal duck stamps to be totally purchased online, which is great. No longer do you have to go to the post office and hope they have a federal duck stamp. And for those of you who hunt, you know how difficult it is to find a federal duck stamp in a lot of post offices. Sporting goods stores all used to carry them. They don't anymore. And for those of you who collect duck stamps, you realize also how hard it was. And I remember a time not too long ago when I was trying to buy a duck stamp, and I had to go to three different post offices and finally got that third post office to call the dispatcher for the region to find out where there were federal duck stamps. You don't have to do that anymore. That's great news. It makes it so much easier. Or in the middle of the night, you realize, I don't have a federal duck stamp and I'm going hunting tomorrow. But here's the bad news. When the Federal Duck Stamp Act was passed in 1934, and it was furthered by individuals who were avid conservationists and waterfowl hunters, they made certain that 98% of the proceeds from the federal duck stamp had to go directly to habitat conservation, purchase, lease, etc. 98%. And this came at a time when the government was reeling from the Depression. The idea of a new tax to buy a federal duck stamp to preserve habitat was extremely unpopular, particularly in business. And yet it was the business leaders of the country, guys like Max McGraw, guys like Henry Ford and others, who got behind the duck stamp. They were the foremost conservationists, and they believed that the duck stamp was necessary, and they got the government to promise that only 2% of the proceeds would ever be taken from the duck stamp to be used for administration. Well, here we are. People might forget these kind of things. So here's what they've done. It's unbelievable, in my view, and goes against the very reason that the federal duck stamp program was enacted to begin with. As you may recall, a few years ago, the price of the duck stamp was increased to $25 from $20. It took a great fight in Congress. It was accomplished. It was actually blocked at one point in Congress under the concept of no new taxes. Well, we were able to convince them this wasn't a tax. So now you go online to buy a duck stamp. The duck stamp is $25. But the federal government has added a $4 federal processing, I'm quoting, federal processing convenience fee. 20% federal processing convenience fee. I don't think that's right. Just to process something online, it's an absolute workaround from what the intent of the Federal Duck Stamp Act was, what has been in place now for nearly 100 years, 90 years, that only 2% could ever be used for administration. The federal government finally figured out a workaround. So your duck stamp actually now costs $29. It doesn't cost $25. It costs $29 if you're going to buy it online because of a 20%. Who's ever heard of a 20% administrative tax for something online? You think Amazon could charge you 20% additionally to buy something? I don't think so. But that's what they've done. It's a workaround from the legislation that has been so well crafted and so well defended for as long as it has been. Hopefully, the members of Congress and the conservation organizations led by Ducks Unlimited and others are going to be able to go in and say, this isn't right. But unfortunately, it's what's going to be taking place right now, that the federal duck stamp program is going to cost you, if you go online, which almost everyone is going to do, it's going to cost you 20% tax. It's a tax to do something online that simply requires pushing a button. I'll be back with much more on the Great Outdoors Show in just a moment. And when I do, I'm going to talk about I talked 2 weeks ago about Colorado and things that were happening there. I'm going to talk about an organization that the New York Times thinks is one of the leading organizations in the country when it comes to the environment. And I did a little research. You'll be interested in it. This is Charlie Potter on the Outdoor Voice of Chicago and America, 720 WGN. And first, a message from our longtime sponsors, the Northwest Indiana and Chicagoland Chevrolet dealers.
Hiking, camping, and hunting, it's all an adventure in the great outdoors, but nature can be tough. You need to be ready for anything and everything. Chevy Silverado is built to handle the toughest conditions and get you everywhere you want to go worry-free. Silverado's designed to handle the big jobs. It's built for the great outdoors. With over 13,000 pounds of towing capacity and trailering sway control, Silverado can haul the biggest loads on the roughest roads and keep you cool as a Sunday drive. With 8 available cameras and up to 14 different views, it can spot trouble before it gets to you. That's peace of mind. And when you're ready for the backcountry, Chevy Silverado 1500 ZR2 owns the off-road. You name it, we run over it. No wonder it's Motor Trend's 2023 four-wheeler pickup truck of the year. So see your Chicagoland and Northwest Indiana Chevy dealer or go to ChevyDriveChicago.com and check out a Chevy Silverado. It's freedom to explore the great outdoors.
It's Charlie Potter and the Great Outdoors on Chicago's very own 720 WGN.
Welcome back to the Great Outdoors Show. Charlie Potter, your host here on WGN Radio. Have you ever heard of the Sunrise Movement? I hadn't, and I've been in the conservation world for quite a while. I'm pretty active in it. I'd like to think I'm somewhat informed, not always informed, but maybe somewhat informed. Well, the New York Times last week, when it was talking about the climate crisis, cited an organization that they said was one of the leading environmental groups in America, Sunrise Movement. I had never heard of them. And I bet you, if any of you listening have heard of them, please let me know. I bet most of you are like me. I've never heard of the Sunrise Movement. How can it be a leading conservation organization? Well, I did what you can do today. I went online and then I made some phone calls, and the Sunrise Movement is not a leading environmental organization. It's an absolutely radical, protest-driven organization whose budget was $800,000. Now, Ducks Unlimited is a couple hundred million a year. World Wildlife's that. Nature Conservancy's that. Audubon's nearly $100 million a year. Those are the players in the conservation movement. A group that goes around the country and protests and throws paint on people and screams that we have a climate crisis, and whose mission statement, according to their website, is to defeat anybody running for Congress who does not believe we have a climate crisis, and to only elect individuals who vow, and I'm reading from their website, who vow that they will not support fossil fuels, that they will only back candidates who take a pledge that they will never vote for any legislation that furthers fossil fuels. That is not a leading environmental group. It's a radical, extreme organization that actually has no money. But the New York Times, for whatever reason, thinks it's a great conservation environmental group. And I would offer that's part of what's going on in conservation today, is there are all these groups that together don't have any money. But what they do is they have the power of a sympathetic press that won't do the work, the background check that used to take place. I think of my great friend Kerry Luft, who you heard on the air last week, when he was the editor of the Chicago Tribune, running the foreign desk around the world as well as the Chicago Tribune. He no more would have let an article go out claiming that something was something that it's not. We have so little control over what's written or said, but you do expect a higher standard from the New York Times, and I'm not picking on the New York Times. They're the ones who elevated this group that is a truly a nothing group into national publication. And if you go to their website, you'll just see it's unbelievable what they believe in. You could argue whether you believe in it or not, but their tactics are absolutely radical. And I can assure you, this group, the Sunrise Movement, does not in any way, shape, or form represent the conservation world that I have spent my life in and that so many of you support. Switching subjects now, I'm going to go to Alaska, and I'm going to end up the show actually talking about salmon. There was a decision recently by the Biden administration, not a political comment on my part, I don't care who the administration is, that has actually caused quite a stir in Alaska as an example of the federal government overreaching on states' rights. And the issue is over where energy can be extracted on public lands in Alaska. Alaska thought it had a deal with the federal government years ago about where they could drill and put pipelines and in areas that so far had not had energy extraction. The federal government today says, nope, we're not going to honor that deal. We are going to restrict areas of Alaska that were supposed to be opened up for natural resource development. We're going to restrict those. It's highly controversial. And there are a lot of conservation organizations that support this initiative to restrict. And there's also a number who don't think it's necessary at this time. There'll be more on that, but it just goes to show that I guess sometimes when you think you have a deal, you don't have one with the federal government, and we talk about that from time to time with the BLM, which seems to certainly be a moving target. Before I go off the air for the day, one last thing I want to talk about, United States and Canada. They've reached a new agreement on the Columbia River, which is really important to Pacific salmon. It's taken a long time to do this, but the bottom line is too much water has been taken out of the Columbia River for other purposes, and the result is that salmon, due to the dams in the Columbia River and the temperature of water in the Columbia River and the lack of water in the tributaries of the Columbia River, salmon are crashing throughout the Columbia River basin and have reached the point in some cases where they really are believed certain species of salmon are going to go extinct. So the Columbia River new pact signed between the United States and Canada redefines how much water will reach the Columbia River from its tributaries. A lot of people don't think it's enough water to protect the salmon that are so badly in need of help, but it is a breakthrough. Anytime the United States and Canada can agree on something, it's a real breakthrough. And they have agreed to a multi-year pact, which will put more water into the tributaries of the Columbia and therefore into the Columbia River, hopefully reducing water temperatures, which should hopefully benefit salmon. The situation of Pacific salmon is dire. I hate to say that because there's so many people working so hard on it. A couple weeks ago, I talked about the Wild Salmon Center and their extraordinary efforts in the Pacific Rim to save salmon. There's going to be an IMAX film made shortly, or it's actually being made, but will be released shortly, about the Columbia River, the Pacific Rim, all the way from California, all the way around to Japan, and how the salmon are the keystone species of the entire ecosystem, and that if we can't save the salmon of the Pacific Northwest and into Alaska and around to Russia and Japan, we likely see an ecosystem that's in collapse. This IMAX film is going to talk about that. There'll certainly be more on that as it gets closer to completion. But this is a bit of good news in the conservation community. And as we wrap up the last Sunday morning in July, I hope you're having a wonderful summer. I'll be back next Sunday morning with much more on the Great Outdoor Show. Thank you so much for listening. This is the Outdoor Voice of Chicago and America, 720 WGN, Charlie Potter, your host.